Chapter 39. That baby was delicious. I don't even remember the first time I did meth in front of my child. This is mostly because I've never actually done meth, but it's a good way to start out a chapter about how you fear that you're failing as a parent because it sets the bar of child rearing very, very low. And everything that you do that isn't meth in front of your children seems incredibly impressive by comparison. My daughter Haley is now 9, and so far she shows none of the crippling anxiety and shyness that I had begun perfecting at her age. When people who know me spend time with her, they are always shocked at how well-adjusted and happy she is. This is an incredibly insulting compliment, but one I have a hard time arguing with, so I usually just say, "Thank you?" Frankly, I think parents have very little input in creating the positive aspects of their children's personalities. My sister and I were raised in the exact same way, and we could not be more different. This is not to say that you can't fuck up a kid by being an asshole, because children are small sponges that will mimic all of your worst behavior at the least opportune time. But I believe that usually your kid's positive qualities come less from your making them awesome and more from just not intentionally squashing the random things they are inherently born with that make them awesome. Some people think this is a cop-out that people like me use in order to justify the fact that I don't have my child enrolled in 287 different extracurricular activities and lessons, and those people are right. I'm sorry, you were probably expecting something defensive and brave right there, but the truth is that I'm terrible at being one of those moms who can sit in the bleachers or dance studios and make forced small talk with parents who all seem to know and secretly hate each other and who never seem to show up in pajamas or mismatched shoes. I am continually saying something awkward and inappropriate like, "I thought this was just for fun," or, "No, actually, I don't think that toddler is too fat for ballet." I believe it was Sartre who said, "Hell is other people," and I suspect he wrote that after spending an hour with over-involved parents who won't stop yelling at coaches, instructors, or crying four-year-olds who really just want a snow cone. Even if you do enroll your kid in one or two lessons or clubs, you're always hearing about some other, better, more exclusive club where they learn to twirl batons while reciting Mandarin poetry. You immediately worry that if you don't enroll your child there, they will end up homeless or legless or be turned into carpet or something. Whatever it is, it must be awful because almost all of the parents that I know seem to be competing to see how much shit they can pack into their child's life. I'm not judging those people, though, because it's not like I haven't tried that route myself. Haley has done gymnastics, piano, jazz, hip-hop, ballet, tumbling, choir, but none of them held her attention for more than a year. She rather enjoyed dance classes, but seemed to be setting a record for how many times she could fall. Honestly, she is smart and beautiful and kind, but she could manage to fall while being duct-taped flat on her back to the floor. When she was 5, she took ballet lessons at one of those classes where the parents aren't allowed inside the studio because some parents are yelly assholes and most studios recognize this. But the lesson played on a closed-circuit television in the lobby so that we could all watch an hour of kindergartners not following instructions in French. Victor and I watched while the small children leaped across the floor until it was Haley's turn, and she did really well, except that she was so busy watching herself in the mirror that she ran right into the wall and then bounced off the wall and fell headfirst into a large rubber trash can. Her tiny, flailing legs were the only things we could see, and we were panicked, but Haley thought it was hilarious after she was pulled out of the trash can. The people who did not find it hilarious were the other parents in the lobby who were not happy about the distraction. I tried to lighten the mood by saying, "Wow, I love that kid, but she cannot hold her alcohol, am I right?" No one laughed. Soon afterward, we moved to the one thing she really excelled at, drama classes. She is a natural on the stage and loves performing in front of hundreds of strangers. I suspect she was switched at birth. When I was a kid in rural Texas, none of this stuff seemed to exist. I didn't even know anyone who took dance classes. No one knew martial arts. You could take band classes in school, but only if you could afford to buy or rent an instrument, and my family couldn't. So instead, when the other kids went to band, I stayed with the poorer kids, and we had a class called Music Memory. It was basically a room filled with old records and a teacher who was usually asleep, and we'd listen to scratchy Mozart pieces while showing each other how switchblades worked and learning how to pick locks. This seems like comedic exaggeration, but it's not. I felt a little sorry for myself at the time because all the cool kids had their shiny boxes of spit valves and flutes, but I learned a lot in Music Memory, and I have had more occasions to pick a lock than I've ever had to play bassoon, so I suppose it all worked out in the end. Still, you feel shitty as a parent if your kids aren't doing what all the other kids are doing. My mom could not have been a more perfect mother, but she never took me to lessons or dedicated entire days to forced quality time with me. So I guess sometimes the example you set is the lesson, and the lesson that I took was learning that the world didn't center on me and that I was responsible for making the most of my time. But my mom read lots to me and, more importantly, in front of me. And that made all the difference. So I guess I also learned that my mom's time was important too. And that's a lesson I'm still trying to learn now when the guilt about Haley's not having a perfectly scheduled life creeps in. Occasionally, Haley complains of being bored. But boredom is good. It makes up most of your life. And if you don't figure out how to conquer it when you're a kid, you're sort of fucked up as an adult. Learning to combat boredom is a lesson in and of itself, and it's one you don't have to drive your kid anywhere for them to learn. The downside, though, is that your kid is probably just like you in that boredom sometimes drives them to do incredibly stupid things. Necessity is the mother of invention, but boredom is the mother of doing bafflingly stupid shit. Setting things on fire, taking apart the TV, riding goats, accidentally eating foot powder, letting 25 tadpoles hatch into frogs in my bedroom because I forgot that I hid them under my bed, exploring abandoned buildings, burning my eyebrows off with a lighter. These were all things that happened to me during periods of boredom, and they were also all things to which I honestly answered, I don't know, when my baffled mother would see the evidence of wrongdoing and ask me what in the hell I was thinking. Frankly, I still don't know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it most of the time, but at least I learned early on that this is a normal state of mind and also that I shouldn't be trusted with fire. Boredom makes you rely on your own imagination or makes you realize how little you have. My sister Lisa and I spent a great deal of our childhood digging holes on our surrounding land for no reason at all. Perhaps when we started, we were making caves or looking for bodies, but in the end, it just became a matter of digging holes deep enough so that we could easily drop into them and disappear completely because it freaked out people driving by to see a child waving furiously in an empty field and then suddenly vanish completely as if being sucked into some sort of parallel dimension. Or at least that's what we imagined it looked like. Probably it just looked like little girls jumping into holes, which is just as baffling to watch. Later, Lisa pointed out that the place where we were often aggressively digging was directly on top of the rusty propane tank buried in the yard, which was probably not the safest thing ever. Luckily, the god of how did children survive in the 70s was looking out for us, and we never ended up in a giant fireball. Although we once lost a series of holes in the tall grass and forgot all about them completely until several months later when we looked up just in time to see our mother drive the riding lawnmower into what looked like a sinkhole. And then she was like, why are there so many holes? We considered claiming it was the mole people who'd created some sort of Scooby-Doo trap, but we didn't have enough time to go over the details. So instead, we calmly explained that there were holes because we dug them. And then she asked why, and we honestly stared at each other and said, I don't know. And that was the truth. We were baffled by it ourselves. And maybe that's why people overschedule their kids now. Maybe it's to avoid driving your lawnmower over a small cliff made by gopher-like children. But still, it seems like it's overkill to schedule away any chance of boredom. It's like when your cat brings you dead mice and you want to yell at her, but you can't because she's just doing it because she thinks you're a really shitty cat who won't survive on your own. We're sort of like that with our children, bringing them private lessons and participation medals and beauty pageant tiaras, as if we suspect that they don't have the ability to succeed at stuff without our forcing them into repetitive drills and buying expensive costumes and spending long weekends at competitions and pageants. Plus, now we've set up our kids to expect to win at everything. And they feel shitty if they don't because they can see how unaccountably emotionally invested we are in their ability to beat other children. When I was a kid, I never won anything. And when I mentioned it to my mom, she looked up from her book and pointed out that I had once been the youngest person in the entire world. Sure, it was only for a millisecond, but it was a record that I had set without even trying. And then I went back to my own book and forgot all about competitions until my own child was born, and then she took the title. Excellence runs in our family, I guess. No one ever warns you about the complicated and political decisions regarding lessons and classes and sports that you have to make when you become a parent. When I was in eighth grade, everyone in home economics had to care for flour sack babies for 2 weeks to teach us about parenting, and no one ever mentioned enrolling your flour baby in sports. Basically, everyone got a sealed paper sack of flour that puffed out flour dust whenever you moved it. You were forced to carry it around everywhere because I guess it was supposed to teach you that babies are fragile and also that they leave stains on all your shirts. And at the end of the 2 weeks, your baby was weighed. And if it lost too much weight, that meant that you were too haphazard with it and you were not ready to be a parent. It was a fairly unrealistic child-rearing lesson. Basically, all we learned about babies in that class was that you could use super glue to seal your baby's head after you dropped it, and that eighth grade boys will play keep away with your baby if they see it, so it's really safer in the trunk of your car, and that you should just wrap your baby up in plastic cling wrap so that its insides don't explode when it's rolling around in your trunk on the way home, and also that if you don't properly store your baby in the freezer, your baby will get weevils, and then you have to throw your baby in the garbage instead of later making it into a cake that you'll be grated on. The next 2 weeks of class focused on cooking, and I used my flour baby to make a pineapple upside-down cake. My baby was delicious. These are the things you never realize are weird until you start writing them down. Anyway, Haley recently decided that she wanted to be in Girl Scouts, and I explained that I kind of felt it was a bit of a cookie pyramid scheme, but she loves it. I go to her troop meetings, and I hide in the back, and I try not to look like I'm uncomfortable around the other parents. Last week, I sat in my usual corner, and as another mother sat down next to me and struck up a light conversation, I silently congratulated myself on being a normal person. A few seconds later, Haley looked up from across the room with the other Girl Scouts and, smiling widely, exclaimed, "Mommy! You made a friend! Good for you!" And then I fell through the floor because being embarrassed by your child when you're an adult is much like being embarrassed by your parents when you're a teenager, but worse because you can't roll your eyes at them and pretend that they just don't understand you. Kids totally understand you, so much more than you want them to. And maybe that's why they're sent off to so many lessons and camps. Maybe it's so their parents can stay home during that time and secretly watch bad TV and cry and eat a bucket of mashed potatoes and put clothes on the cats without getting harshly but accurately judged by their own children. Now it all makes a little more sense. Chapter 40. These cookies know nothing of my work. "But I don't want to be a grown-up," I screamed from a vaguely fetal position in the corner of the office. "I'm just not ready for this yet." It was a major psychological breakthrough, and one I felt certain that my shrink would have been very proud of had she actually been there. Instead, my husband and our CPA stared at me as if this were the first time that something like this had ever happened during an initial financial planning meeting. "I'm not really with her," Victor mumbled. He said it more out of habit, but it seemed like a bit of a weak argument, considering that he was holding a giant folder of papers, proving that we had bought a lot of shit together over the last 17 years. Or Perhaps it was the folder of evidence he was compiling to have me committed. If it was the latter, I was fairly certain that this incident was going to end up in there. "Whoa there! No judgments here," said our CPA, Maury, as he held up his hands with caution, like you might to someone about to jump off the edge of a building or to a rabid dog that you hoped understood English. Then he said something about how he was, quote, "just here to help people get their finances in order." But what I heard was, "We're here to discuss how terrible you are at being a responsible, normal person. There are hidden cameras everywhere, and this is all going on YouTube. I'm going to be super rich." Honestly, I consider myself to be fairly good at finances if you don't compare me to normal people. I make more money than I deserve, and then I give away a lot because it makes me nervous to have it around. I pay bills when the paper that they're printed on turns pink or gets threatening. And if my debit card is still accepted, then I feel like I'm winning. At the end of the year, I go to the tax office and I throw a box of receipts marked evidence at the tax lady. There is a proper word for her job, but I have not learned it. And then I run away before she can tell me that I'm fired from being her client. She usually screams something like, "QuickBooks!" And then I scream back, "I'm totally going to start doing that today, pinky promise!" And then I duck into the bushes before she can realize that most of the receipts are actually just napkins with scribbles on them. Things like, "I needed to buy a kangaroo outfit for work, but the flea market doesn't give out receipts. It was $15, but it was worth like $100. I can't confirm this, but the blonde guy at the flea market who doesn't wear deodorant says that he can be a witness if we need him." This seems like it's a terrible way of keeping records, but I can assure you it is much better than the year that I meticulously attempted to keep all of my receipts in a box under my desk until the cat mistook it for a litter box, or the year that I kept a bunch of receipts in a clear plastic envelope, and then when I went to pull them all out, half of them were just blank pieces of paper. Turns out, if you expose receipts to sunlight, they eventually just fade away, much like my intentions to keep receipts. Instead, I just wrote what I thought should be on the now blank pieces of paper. Things like, "I bought a dead weasel for $40, but then I dressed her up and made her into Christmas cards for clients." Or things like, "I think this was a receipt for a haunted Cupid doll that I wrote about and then I sold on eBay, but then eBay unlisted it because I said that it possibly contained the souls of eaten children, and then eBay pulled the auction because they said it was against the rules to sell souls." This is all on my blog if you need proof. In my defense, I suspect that my tax accountant probably enjoys doing my returns. I'd enjoy them too if math weren't involved, because looking through them is a glimpse into a life well lived. Or a life that needs massive sorting out. A few of my business expenses. Taxidermied wolf I wore to watch Twilight at the local theater. His name was Wolf Blitzer, and he died of natural causes. Go Team Jacob. Full body kangaroo costume worn to impress and infiltrate a band of wild kangaroos while on writing assignment in Australia. See previous chapter, Koalas Are Full of Chlamydia. Tetanus shot needed immediately after my trip to Australia. Postage to ship home a brain that someone gave me while I was on book tour. A taxidermied Pegasus for the cats to ride on. A box of Cobra. A rented live sloth. Stylish outfits for cats. 2 super ecstatic taxidermied raccoon corpses for late night cat rodeos. Then the tax lady would call and say, "But what about your server costs and your office supplies and your real operating expenses?" And I would explain that I don't really know them because I only keep up with the interesting receipts. And then she'd call Victor to get his help and he would scream at me, "You're paying too much in taxes because you're not being responsible with deductions." And I would scream back, "Well, maybe the government needs the money more than I do." And then Victor would question why he had ever married anyone who wasn't Republican, and I'd question why anyone would ever trust me to do taxes to begin with. And this was probably why I was feeling a little defensive at the CPA's office. It was our first meeting and was filled with questions that made me immediately uncomfortable and sort of defensively stabby. Maury asked if I had life insurance, and I assured him that I didn't because I didn't want Victor to be arrested. And there was this pause in the conversation. She thinks that life insurance is only taken out on people about to be murdered, Victor explained stoically. It's true, though, I continued. Whenever someone ends up in the meat grinder, the authorities are always quick to arrest whoever the beneficiary is on the insurance policy. Victor rolled his eyes. I'm trying to help you with your murder defense, I yelled politely. Then Victor huffed a bit, but probably because I'd accidentally said meat grinder instead of chipper shredder. Victor would never murder me with our meat grinder. He is such a germaphobe. He can't even handle it if I leave a used Kleenex on my desk, so there's no way he's going to be able to make his summer sausage after he knows that I've been through our grinder. I mean, who knows where I've been? Eventually, Victor and Maury got back to discussing investment strategies and mathy stuff, and I blinked out a bit until I noticed that they were both staring at me. Maury repeated himself, "Do you have any questions so far or anything you'd like to add?" I didn't, but I wanted to contribute to the conversation, so I asked, why is there a gold standard? Victor and Maury looked at me because the question apparently had nothing to do with what they had been discussing, but I thought it was still a good question, so I continued, I just don't understand the gold standard. If America found a planet made of gold, would that make us super rich, or would it make all gold worthless? And if it did make us super rich, what's keeping all the other countries from being like, we don't like gold anymore because this isn't fair. We like spiders now. Pay us in spiders. Would that make our economy collapse? Could you buy spiders with gold? What would the exchange rate be? Would it be metric or imperial? I already can't remember how to convert metric. And it's going to get even worse if I have to convert to metric spiders. And that's why I don't think we should go around mining on other planets and looking for trouble. Because I don't want to carry a purse around filled with hordes of spiders. That's why. Got it, said Victor. You're blocking out all of our conversations because you're too focused on how you would pay for things with spiders. I guess so, I said. Having a purse full of spiders is actually less scary than having to think about finances. Wow, that's sort of a breakthrough. I let out a deep breath and looked at Maury. I should totally come to see you instead of my normal shrink. Maury replied. Would it be tax deductible if I came to see you for mental problems, I asked. And also, are you licensed to prescribe drugs? Because that's sort of a deal breaker. Victor shook his head. It's like you're allergic to making sense. He seemed a bit snappish, but probably because of the spider thing. I'd be pissed too if I spent years trying to save money and suddenly realized it could all be replaced by spiders and I'd be fucked. I placed a soothing hand on Victor's sleeve and whispered, I hear and acknowledge your pain. This is not therapy, he barked. This is financial planning. He looked slightly frazzled and I considered slipping some of my Xanax into his coffee, but then I thought that maybe my possible new therapist would see me as being a little too free with drugs. And so instead I said, well, it's sort of both, isn't it? Maury changed the subject to funeral planning and wills, and I blanked out again a little. Personally, I've always been a bit icked out by wills, mostly because of the math involved. I'm fine with funeral planning and dead bodies and all that stuff. In fact, I recently saw a coffin in a magazine that I wanted that had, Hi, coffin, you look nice, written on the side, and I thought that was very clever and would put everyone at ease while they were grieving me, and so I told Victor that he could buy me that one, or if it was too expensive, he could just buy me a cheap casket and then stencil that shit on the side himself, but then Victor got all yelly about my talking about funerals again, probably because he's bad at arts and crafts, or maybe because he knows that after going through the chipper shredder, I won't need anything more than a small cocktail shaker to hold what's left of me. And in a way, that would be nice, though, because I'd finally get to go to an event where I was the thinnest person there. And then I realized that Victor and Maury were staring at me and that they'd asked me a question about the will, but I couldn't remember what it was, so I just said, when I die, I would like all my stuff to be left to my cat. Then Victor just rubbed his temples and I explained, not really, though, because there's no way Ferris Mueller is outliving me. And Hunter S. Tomcat is way too irresponsible to take on that sort of money. But this way, you can just tell everyone that I am obviously insane if I'm leaving shit to a cat. And then you can just handle all the will stuff yourself. And I don't have to do any of this paperwork. We all win. Except Hunter S. Tomcat, I guess. He better find himself a sugar mama or something. Victor sighed, but frankly, I'm not sure what he'd expected. It was my job to accidentally make money and his job to make sure that I didn't lose it when I was doing wobbly cartwheels in the parking lot after the bars closed. Our roles had been clearly defined. Maury cleared his throat. You know what? We can come back to wills later. How about retirement plans? Victor spent the next several minutes speaking in a combination of words and letters that I'm pretty sure meant, I have a retirement plan and it's quite good. Maury looked at me expectantly. I have a drawer I put change into. Victor put his head into his hands. Not quarters, though. I use those for gum. Then Victor and Maury talked about dividends and stipends and split-ins, and then Victor woke me up an hour later to sign things that looked far too important for me to sign. I agreed to sign them if he would take me somewhere for lunch where I could have some booze, and Maury recommended a place in the same building, which was very convenient because I was so overwhelmed, I didn't think I could make it very far. In fact, when we got downstairs to the cafe, the waiter asked what I would like to drink, and I said, I would like booze, but I don't have it in me to make any more decisions today, so you just pick something for me, will you? And he did. And it was very strong. And I suspect that Maury sends all of his easily overwhelmed clients there, and that's probably the Maury special. I laid my head down on the table, and Victor wondered aloud how I would ever manage to live if he wasn't there. Well, my life would be much simpler, I explained with perfect honesty. I don't know how the 8 remotes for the TV work, so I'd never use it again. And when the lights burnt out, I'd just sort of leave them if I couldn't reach them with a chair. And when the computers broke, I'd probably throw them in a ditch. And when my car stopped working, I'd probably just buy a donkey to ride into town to buy provisions from the gas station. I suspect I'd become accidentally Amish within a year. In fact, I bet the Amish are just a whole tribe of people who didn't have someone around to turn on the TV for them for, like, several generations and finally said, fuck it, we're just gonna live life this way. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not even remotely accurate, Victor replied. Well, I would look it up online, but I tried to update iTunes this morning, and now my phone is frozen, and so I think I'm just gonna use it as a paperweight from now on. Victor stared at me. That was a joke, I explained. But actually, I did manage to somehow delete half of my icons, so if you could help me out there, I would really appreciate it. No rush, though. I know you've had a tough morning. You have no idea, he said. Actually, I do. I mean, I realize I am ridiculously inept when it comes to, you know, things. Stuff like money and planning and complicated television sets. But what you don't think about is that I am fantastic with people. Except when I'm hiding from them, obviously. But I'm here to make things lovely and good and to make sure that everyone is happy. Everyone except for Maury, I mean. He seemed a bit flustered. Yeah, there's a lot of that going around, Victor replied. But he said it in a way that made me think that he agreed. Or that he just didn't have a way to respond properly. Just please do your best to be a little more financially responsible and we'll be fine. I nodded and kissed him on the cheek, and then excused myself to powder my nose. But then, when I was walking down the hall to go to the bathroom, I saw it. The giant Zoltar fortune-telling machine from the movie Big. The same one that turned Tom Hanks into a successful grown-up. And so I immediately decided that I needed to have my fortune told, and I ran back to Victor, and I told him that I needed some quarters to see what our fortune was. You want to take our money and throw it away on a fortune-telling machine. Have you learned nothing today? Well, I learned you're pretty stingy with quarters. You know perfectly well I've spent all mine on gum. Plus, it's only 50 cents for advisement on our future. Or for getting a fortune. Something like that. And that's what this whole day has been about, right? He sighed and fished out a bunch of quarters. The first fortune was for me. And it was so perfect, I ran back to the table to share it. Your fortune. Your future life will be very sunny. I see it in a chest full of money. Be free to spend it as you see fit, because there will be plenty more of it. So basically, Zoltar told me that I am fiscally sound and that I had wasted the whole day setting up retirement plans when I just needed to spend as much as I could out of my never-ending chest of money. Victor did not agree, so I went to go get his fortune so that I could prove how remarkably accurate it was. This was his fortune. I'll paraphrase. What a joy to look ahead to read the signs of your future. So much happiness is in store for you that the most brilliantly lighted stairs will be put to shame by the brightness of your life. Ah, this is not all caused by sheer good luck. Nay, nay, my friend, your perseverance, your clever way of handling your domestic problems, and your sincerity in dealing with others are pointing the way to their reward. See, I said, according to Zoltar, you've got tons of happiness in the future, and it's all caused by your perseverance and clever way of handling your domestic problems. I think you might be my domestic problems. Well, I said, either way, everything's coming up roses, right? And then Victor laughed in spite of himself. And that's how you know you've got a real fortune, because money can't buy the happiness of a good and understanding spouse. But it can buy a new phone when you've accidentally dropped it in the toilet after having too many Maury specials. P.S. After dinner, the waiter brought us fortune cookies, and I was like, 4 fortunes in one day? What a boon! Victor said cookies weren't really the same thing as actual fortune, but I think Victor is underestimating the importance of cookies. But then we opened them and decided just to stick to Zoltar because mine said, no snowflake in an avalanche ever feels responsible. And I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be insulting, although it also implies that I'm somehow responsible. And I think that proves that I've gotten the wrong cookie. But then Victor opened his and said, mine says, never argue with a fool. What? I said, that's what our whole marriage is based on. Victor shrugged. Well, this cookie is telling me not to talk to you. I crossed my arms. Well, this cookie is making me feel guilty, and I don't even know what I've done. Victor nodded. Well, the cookie has a point. You can't tell us what to do, cookies. You don't even know us, I might have yelled. And that's when we decided to not take advice from cookies anymore. And Victor also tried to make me not take advice from fortune-telling robots near bathrooms. But I said that was just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And that's bad financial advice for everyone, unless your baby is really spendy. But still, I think it's a good idea to keep them, even if they do end up costing you time and money, because they're worth all the fuss because of the joy that they bring into your life. And Victor smiled and held my hand and agreed. I don't think we were talking about the same thing, but it's nice to see him smile, and so I smiled back and we walked out of the restaurant to face the future together. Unknown, uncertain, dangerously entertaining, and furiously happy. Chapter 41. It might be easier, but it wouldn't be better. I am at the final part of a severe rheumatoid arthritis flare-up. I only get a few a year, but when they hit, it is simply a matter of surviving from day to day. That sounds ridiculous and overblown, since I at least know that the pain will eventually fade and I'll be able to get out of bed and not bite back the screams. The first few days seem like they should be the worst, since they're the most painful and they always end up with a trip to the emergency room. The next few days, it hurts less, but you're so brittle from a lack of sleep and unending pain that you still feel just as miserable. Your family members and friends understand and care, but after a half a week of seeing you hobbling around the house and crying in the bathroom, even they can get worn out by it all. Then comes 2 days of fatigue so intense that you feel drugged. You want to get up and work and clean and smile, but you find yourself falling asleep at your daughter's first play, and then you have to leave to get back into bed while everyone else celebrates. Life passes, then comes the depression, that feeling that you'll never be right again, that fear that these outbreaks will become more familiar, or worse, never go away. You're so tired from fighting that you want to start to listen to all the little lies that your brain tells you. The ones that say that you're a drain on your family, the ones that say it's all in your head, the ones that say that if you were stronger or better, this wouldn't be happening to you. The ones that say that there's a reason why your body is trying to kill you and that you should just stop all of the injections and steroids and drugs and therapies. Last month, as Victor drove me home so I could rest, I told him that sometimes I felt like his life would be easier without me. He paused a moment in thought and then said, "It might be easier, but it wouldn't be better. I remind myself of that sentence on days when the darkness seems like it'll never end. But I know it'll pass. I know that tomorrow things will seem a little brighter. I know that next week I will look back on this sentence and think, I should stop listening to my brain when it's trying to kill me. Why did I even write this? And that's precisely why I'm writing this now, because it is so easy to forget that I've been here before and come out on the other side. And perhaps if I have this to read, I'll remember it again next time, and it'll help me to keep on breathing until the medications take hold and I'm out of the hole again. I used to feel a lot of guilt about having depression, but then I realized that's a lot like feeling guilty for having brown hair. Still, even though it's unrealistic, it's normal. I felt the same when Smokey the Bear was all, only you can prevent forest fires, and I was like, shit, only me? Because that seems like it should be more of a team effort, and also, I don't think I should be taking orders about forest from bears, because some bears use forest to hide in so that they can eat you. So basically, I have some demanding bear shaming me into creating a less fiery dining room for him to devour me. And also, that doesn't even make sense, because aren't some forest fires caused by lightning? Because I can't stop lightning, bears. I'm not God. I can't stop lightning or swamp gas or spontaneous combustion or depression. These are all things that just happen and shouldn't be blamed on me. Stop blaming the victim, bears. In the years since I first came out about struggling with mental illness, I have been asked if I regret it, if the stigma is too much to handle. It's not. There are terrible sides to illness, mental and physical, but it's strangely freeing that my personal struggle is obvious and has to be acknowledged. And in a way, I'm lucky. My depressions and periods of anxiety and paranoia were so extreme that I couldn't keep them much of a secret. I felt like not writing about them was creating a false history, and honestly, when I first wrote about them, I expected that I would lose readers. I expected that I'd scare people. I expected that some people would feel betrayed, that someone that they turned to for light and funny fluff was pulling them into serious and difficult dreck. I expected silence. I did not expect what I was given. What I got back in return for being honest about my struggle was an enormous wave of voices saying, "You aren't alone," and "We suspected you were crazy anyway. We're still here. And I'm proud of you." And louder than all of that were the whispers that became stronger every day from thousands and thousands of people creeping to the edge and quietly admitting, "Me too. I thought it was just me." And the whispers became a roar, and the roar became an anthem that carried me through some of my darkest moments. I did not ride that wave alone. I have a folder that's labeled the Folder of 24. Inside it are letters from 24 people who were actively in the process of planning their suicide, but who stopped and got help, not because of anything that I wrote on my blog, but because of the amazing response from the community of people who read it and said, "Me too." They were saved by the people who wrote about losing their mother or father or child to suicide and how they would do anything to go back and convince them not to believe the lies that mental illness tells you. They were saved by the people who offered up encouragement and songs and lyrics and poems and talismans and mantras that worked for them and that might work for a stranger in need. There are 24 people alive today who are still here because people were brave enough to talk about their struggles, or compassionate enough to convince others of their worth, or who simply said, "I don't understand your illness, but I know that the world is better with you in it." In the days when I was doing my book tour for Let's Pretend This Never Happened, I was often asked whether I regretted going public with my struggles, and my answer is still the same. Those 24 letters are the best payment I ever got for writing, and I never would have gotten any of them without the amazing community that helped save those lives. I am incredibly lucky and grateful to be part of a movement that made such a difference. And it doesn't stop. When I first started talking about my folder of 24, I was shocked at how many people would whisper in my ear at book signings that they were number 25. One girl was 15 years old, and her parents were with her. One woman had two small children. One man who decided to get therapy instead of commit suicide brought his whole family with him. Each time, I wondered at how any of them could ever consider that life would be better without them. And then I remembered that it's the same thing that I struggle with when my brain tries to kill me. And so they've saved me too. That's why I continue to talk about mental illness, even at the cost of scaring people off or having people judge me. I try to be honest about the shame that I feel because with honesty comes empowerment and also understanding. I know that if I go out on a stage and have a panic attack, I can duck behind the podium and hide for a minute and no one is going to judge me. They already know I'm crazy and they still love me in spite of it. In fact, some of them love me because of it. Because there is something wonderful in accepting someone else's flaws, especially when it gives you the chance to accept your own and see that those flaws are the things that make us human. I do worry that one day other kids will taunt my daughter when they're old enough to read and know my story. Sometimes I wonder if the best thing to do is just to be quiet and stop waving the banner of fucked up and proud of it. But I don't think that I will put down this banner until someone takes it away from me. Because quitting might be easier, but it wouldn't be better. The epilogue. Deep in the trenches. To all who walk the dark path, and to those who walk in the sunshine but hold out a hand in the darkness to travel beside us, brighter days are coming. Clearer sights will arrive, and you will arrive too. No, it might not be forever. The bright moments might be for a few days at a time, but hold on for those days. Those days are worth the dark. In the dark, you find yourself all bones and exhaustion and helplessness. In the dark, you find your basest self. In the dark, you find the bottom of watery trenches the rest of the world only sees the surface of. You will see things that no normal person will ever see. Terrible things. Mysterious things. Things that will try to burrow into your mind like a bad seed. Things that whisper dark and horrid secrets that you want to forget. Things that scream lies. Things that want you dead. Things that will stop at nothing to pull you down further and kill you in the most terrible way of all, by your own trembling hand. These things are fearsome monsters, the kind you always knew would sink their needle-sharp teeth and pull you under the bed if you left a dangling limb out. You know they aren't real, but when you're in that black, watery hole with them, they are the realest thing there is, and they want us dead. And sometimes they succeed, but not always, and not with you. You are alive. You have fought and battled them. You are scarred and worn and sometimes exhausted and were perhaps even close to giving up, but you did not. You have won many battles. There are no medals given out for these fights, but you wear your armor and your scars like an invisible skin, and each time you learn a little more. You learn how to fight. You learn which weapons work. You learn who your allies are. You learn that these monsters are exquisite liars who will stop at nothing to get you to surrender. Sometimes you fight valiantly with fists and words and fury. Sometimes you fight by pulling yourself into a tiny ball, blotting out the monsters along with the rest of the world. Sometimes you fight by giving up and turning it over to someone else who can fight for you. And sometimes you just fall deeper. And in the deepest, night-blind fathoms, you're certain that you're alone. You aren't. I'm there with you, and I'm not alone. Some of the best people are here too, feeling blindly, waiting, crying, surviving, painfully stretching their souls so that they can learn to breathe underwater, so they can do what the monsters say is impossible, so they can live, and so they can find their way back to the surface with the knowledge of things that go bump in the night, so that they can dry themselves in the warm light that shines so brightly and easily for those above the surface, so they can walk with others in the sunlight, but with different eyes. Eyes that still see the people underwater, allowing them to reach out into the darkness to pull up fellow fighters, or to simply hold their cold hands and sit beside the water to wait patiently for them to come up for air. Ground Zero is where normal people live their lives, but not us. We live in the negatives so often that we begin to understand that life when the sun shines should be lived full throttle, soaring. The invisible tether that binds the normal people on their steady course doesn't hold us in the same way. Sometimes we walk in sunlight with everyone else. Sometimes we live underwater and fight and grow. And sometimes we fly. Okay, if you are hearing this, it means you bought the audiobook, and it means that you get, a bonus chapter. And this is it. I hope you enjoy it. I have a very large social network, if you include the imaginary friends and all of the people yelling in my head. I am a natural introvert, and I used to feel quite bad about that because I thought it was weird, but it turns out that there are tons of us, but none of us were aware of it because we were all too busy not talking to each other. Then the internet was invented, and the introverts united, but separately and in our own houses, and we realized that there are more of us than them, and there are so many of us, we could probably take over the world if the world wasn't so full of people we'd be forced to talk to in person. I suspect a lot of well-known people were introverts, like Robert Frost, who encouraged people to take the road less traveled, which sounds like someone wanting to avoid people, but if everyone took the road less traveled, it would become the busiest street ever. Basically, his advice boiled down to avoid traffic, use deserted alleys. Robert Frost was totally an introvert. Or a mugger. Even people I think of as extroverts often tell me that they secretly feel awkward and alone. And it's ironic because when you feel utterly alone, you are probably the most not alone because pretty much everyone else is feeling alone too. If anything, people who don't feel alone are the anomaly and are more likely to be alone in feeling that way. That just got confusing. Let me clarify. You are not alone in feeling alone. So I think that just means I just called you a liar. Damn it. Ugh, this is exactly why I shouldn't be allowed to talk to people. Okay, I compensate for not having a very active social life in a variety of very healthy ways, like spending time with my imaginary friends. I highly suggest it. When I was a kid, speckle-headed Susan would always sit next to me on the bus. And when someone else tried to sit there, I would scream, "You're killing my friend!" And then they'd move away, and I'd end up with an empty seat to put my stuff in. Once, I sat on speckle-headed Susan's lap by mistake, and she was like, "Who do I look like, Santa Claus?" And it was funny, because she did. That is the great thing about imaginary friends. You can dress them up in Santa costumes in your mind, and they're just fine with it. Unlike live friends who are like, "Why are you doing this to me?" And, "I'm not going to dress like a panda to go to the mall." I also talk to myself a lot, which is nice until I get tired of myself. Some people say that they don't talk to themselves, but I think those people are just lying to themselves, which you can't do without talking to yourself. And I think I just proved my point. Frankly, I do more than just talk to myself. I ask myself questions, and sometimes I am legitimately surprised by the answers. I can't tell if that's brilliant or crazy. You think you know yourself, but you don't. Occasionally, I will bring things up and have imaginary fights with people in my mind. Imaginary fights, I mean, not imaginary people. That would be crazy. If you're fighting with your imaginary friend, you need to maybe reevaluate your definition of friend. When I'm driving, in my head, I often debate with Victor about whatever it was that we argued about last, and I almost always win, And then I'll come home and I'll be like, I forgive you, because I feel bad for him that he did so embarrassingly bad in the argument in my head. I think that this is what has kept us married, me talking to the voices in my head and being so compassionate and forgiving of their idiocy. People who are familiar with my writing are often unnerved by the fact that I am disappointingly nice and seemingly quiet in real life. This is my defense mechanism. You might be thinking, God, she hates me because I'm so quiet, but in real life, I am imagining a series of horrifically inappropriate things that I should not say during the silence. In short, we may have stood in terrible, mostly silence for several minutes, but I assure you that we had an incredibly fascinating and unforgettable experience in my head. In truth, I'm just being silent because I'm saving you from the horrible conversation about the time that I was sitting on Victor's parents' couch and I realized that their Weimaraner had pulled my used maxi pad out of the bathroom trash and had brought it into the living room to chew on. And I was trying to get it away from her without everyone noticing, but then she barked at me like, get your own, this one's mine. And I chased her around the house until she dropped it, but it was too late. She had a taste for blood. The world has tried to trick me out of my house, but it never works. Last month, I got an email from a fancy TV producer who wanted me to host a half-hour cat show, and I was initially intrigued, but it turns out that she had misspelled chat show, and I was like, Jesus, that sounds awful. Do you have any idea how terrible it would be to have to keep up an awkward conversation with strangers for 30 minutes straight? But cats don't talk at all, she countered. Yes, but they are excellent listeners, I explained to someone who was obviously a dog person. You start talking to a cat, and you don't know where you'll end up. It's madness. One minute, you're talking about how Mrs. Roper would be fun to drink with, and then the cat gives you this quizzical look, so you say, what, you think she's dead? And then you look it up, and bingo, she is dead. The cat just announced the news. Unless she's not dead. I didn't look it up because there weren't enough cats in this email to make me inquisitive enough to Google it. I sent her a few sample conversations that I've had with my cats, but she didn't reply. And yes, they're fairly one-sided, but that's because you're just reading the transcripts. Cats act with their eyes. They are the small, silent film actors of their time, and they are vastly underrated. They are emotive and subtle. Plus, they don't get all judgy and insulted if you say something stupid. They just look at you like, tell me more about why you think that spiders are small land octopuses. I would call the show, What's with the Forks? Because I bet cats are baffled by that one since they don't have thumbs to use utensils except for Ferris Mueller, who was born deformed. Although we prefer the less hurtful phrase, overly formed. And he has thumbs, although he still never uses forks. He does, however, use his thumbs to open doors because he has no sense of privacy. And so we had to change the door handles on all the bathroom doors to something more round and slippery. The door handle changes are not for us. We have learned the importance of locking. It's for guests who have been walked in on by a cat. Now Ferris just desperately grasps at the doorknob and jiggles it furiously while the guest, who doesn't realize that it's a cat and not someone with a violently misfiring colon, yells, "Someone's in here!" Unsuccessfully, because the cat is jiggling the handle. Oh, he knows someone is in there. That's why he's doing the jiggling. The best move is just to take the cat into the bathroom with you, because cats don't care, and at best they'd be like, nice junk. On the other hand, it might seem weird that you brought an animal in with you to the bathroom. Once at a dinner party, my husband tripped, and there was this yelp, and he said, sorry, I fell into your dog. And it caused quite an awkward moment at the dinner party, until he explained that he meant to say, I fell onto your dog. And we all laughed and laughed. Well, I laughed. Victor was asked to leave. And that was fine because I hate dinner parties. I have had other opportunities that clashed with my introvertism as well. I was once asked to judge a competitive taxidermy reality television show, and I was trying to find a reason to say no, but it got canceled first. Oh, well, I said when the producer called to let me down, there's always the next competitive taxidermy reality television show. It hasn't happened yet, but it's only a matter of time. I was also once felt out. I originally wrote felt up, and that was wrong, but it would have made the news, by Katie Couric's people when she still had her talk show about maybe being a roving reporter focusing on what's happening in Texas. But I pointed out that even I don't care what's happening in Texas, and I've lived here all my life. Instead, I offered to do a segment where I just stay home and talk to my taxidermied animals as if they were ventriloquist dummies, and they said they'd get back to me. That was several years ago. I assume they're still thinking about it. Acknowledgements. I owe an immense debt to my parents and sister for giving me these stories and also the ability to truly appreciate how bizarre and wonderful they are. Thank you to my husband for being the straight man in this book and the funny man in my life. You are my home. Thank you to my daughter for being amazing and letting me write about her, even though she did refuse to let me write that one really funny thing about Ada Lovelace. Haley, I assume that you are not letting me write about it because you are keeping it for your own future memoir, and I salute you for your foresight. Thank you to my dead grandparents for not haunting me. Thank you to my live grandparents for supporting me, even when normal people would distance themselves. I love you all. Thank you to Neethi Madan, the greatest agent ever, who understands my weirdness and calls me after every professional conference phone call because she knows that I will need someone to tell me I'm not an idiot. Thank you to the brilliant Amy Einhorn, who continues to believe in me, even though I do refuse to use proper punctuation and randomly make up words. Thank you to the editors and the proofreaders, who are probably all angry alcoholics after working on this book. Thank you to Jeremy Johnson for making Rory 1 and Rory 2, and to my father for spending an entire day wiring and sculpting prosthetic limbs for my dead raccoon amputee. Thank you to the wonderful group of people who read my stuff before it's even close to being polished and who listen to my insane chapters over and over at ridiculous hours. Laura Mays, Miley Wilson, Karen Walron, Brene Brown, Lisa Burr, Stephen Paralini. These books would not exist without you. Thank you to the lovely and talented Andrew Cantor, who took a picture of a vicious possum so I didn't have to. You are one of God's bravest creatures, Andrew. Thank you to Mary Farrows, who keeps me out of jail and makes me seem like a grown-up. Thank you to Brooke Shaden, the immortal Nancy W. Capps paralegal, Jason Wilson, Dr. Q, Ali Brosh, Neil Gaiman, Will and Ann Wheaton, Bonnie Burton, Denny Kendig, Kim Bauer, One Classy Mother, Craig, Amanda, Felicia, Christine from ButYouDon'tLookSick.com, and everyone else who has helped so generously. Thank you to my dedicated readers who bought my first book even though there was a dead mouse on it, and to the booksellers and librarians and book buyers and the people who work in bookshops who write nice things about me. Thank you to the people who sneak into bookshops and find my books and put them up front in illegal displays. Thank you to everyone who ever came to a book tour or was brave enough to suggest one of my books for their book club. A giant and vaguely passive-aggressive thank you to my fellow writers and bloggers who just keep getting better and make me have to work harder. Thank you to everyone who helped me dispose of a body. Thank you to my first grade teacher who celebrated my weirdness. Thank you to my eighth grade teacher who said I wouldn't amount to anything because it spurred me to prove you wrong and also to glue your desk shut. Thank you to the people who voted in the poll that I put up about whether I could write "He was later drugged to his death by catfish" instead of "He was later dragged to his death by catfish." And thank you to everyone who realized that the word "foxin" and "problemly" were intentional mistakes. Thank you to the person that I forgot to list here for being so incredibly understanding and forgiving. Everyone said that you would be bitter and butthurt, but I knew better. And finally, thank you to you for being you. You are better than enchiladas or cupcakes, or enchilada cupcakes, which should totally exist. By the way, I do have those poll results in case you're interested. 31% of people polled said, "Sweet baby Jesus, I will punch you in the neck if you use the words rug incorrectly." 23% said, "You can use drug as dialect, but only if you are prepared to get yelled at." 18% said, "Can't you just say yanked?" 14% said, as long as you don't use the phrase fixin' to, you're fine by me. And another 14% said, I never use words improperly. I cannot believe you drug me into this mess. The end.
We hope you've enjoyed Furiously Happy. This program was produced and directed by Laura Wilson. Post-production by Tim Franklin. Text copyright 2015 by Jenny Lawson. Production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.